Welcome to episode 190 of the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. Long exposures can push a photographer and our gear a little bit out of our comfort zones, but they can also be a lot of fun. A month ago, I was reminded of this when I did some long exposure photography over at a small town called Owarai, which roughly translates as the Big Wash, in the Ibaraki Prefecture here in Japan. I've been doing a lot of travelogue type podcasts lately, so today I thought I'd move away from that and do a sort of 10-step guide, but of course interweave some of my real-world example shots to make the points easier to understand. The last two that we finish with are actually from the ORI shoot, but the ones before that are just selected from previous shoots. So let's jump right into it and discuss what it takes to get great long exposure photographs. Firstly, let's make a distinction between long exposure and slow shutter speeds. It's just really the terminology I'm talking about here. I personally, in this context, I personally don't like to use the term slow shutter speed, because it's pretty subjective. If you're shooting a flying bird, for example, at 1/60th of a second, this would be considered a slow shutter speed if you were trying to freeze the movement in the bird's wings, because it's obviously going to take a little bit faster shutter speed than that to do so. It may not, though, be slow enough if you want to, say, pan with the bird and create that beautiful sign shape that you get made if you manage to capture the wing movement. The same 60th of a second will also not really be slow enough if you want to make, say, a large body of water smooth over into a dreamy blur. Anyway, that's really, you know, just getting that out of the way. Let's jump in and start to look at my 10 steps. Step one is to find a subject that will be complemented by a long exposure. As we get into step one, let's bring up image number 1802, which will be on your screen now if you're listening in iTunes or on an iPhone or iPod, or you can view the images on the podcasts page at martinbaileyphotography.com. So the first thing that you need to do is to decide on a subject that will be improved or have something accentuated by capturing it with a long exposure. It could be shots of, say, firework displays, lightning strikes, car light trails, that, you know, that you've seen them. There's a lot of different types of long exposure shots out there. I've done a number of these, and I've got some example images, but, you know, maintaining my main sort of nature photography theme here, I thought I'd look at this landscape shot from almost a year ago in Nagano Prefecture. I talked about this image in episode 141 as well. There are a few points that we'll make while looking at this image, but the first, as I say, is finding a subject that will work with a long exposure. Your entire shoot doesn't necessarily have to revolve around the long exposure shot. You know, you might go out with just that shot in mind, but, you know, in this image particularly was a pretty opportunistic shot. I turned a corner on the way to the hotel and just literally saw this scene and knew instantly that it would make for a nice long exposure image. There were both the heavy clouds, very textured clouds in the sky, and then there was thick cloud layer down there in the valley, both of which would blur nicely with a multi-second exposure. And it was also getting pretty dark, with literally just a few minutes of reasonable light left in the sky. So I had to move quickly. This image was shot at f11 with ISO 100 for 20 seconds. Not incredibly long yet, but it was long enough for the clouds to sort of move towards me, making this wonderful sort of radiating pattern in the sky. This is accentuated, of course, because I was using a wide-angle lens and the clouds closer to me were going to appear to be moving faster than those in the distance as well. The 20-second exposure was long enough to make the clouds in the valley blur, making them almost look like that it's a lake down there rather than just clouds in the valley. And all of that sort of happening behind the silhouetted foreground trees. That leads us nicely on to step two, which is to include a static anchor object. I find that long exposure images work well when you have something that will remain stationary in the image. It doesn't necessarily have to be in the foreground, but if you don't have something in the shot that doesn't move, then the whole thing becomes a blur. And although that can work, and indeed is the theme for the current assignment, it's not going to be as powerful as having some rock solid anchor for the eye. In the image that we're looking at here right now, the line of trees is the anchor. It's a sharp, solid line for us to come back to keep everything in perspective, with that big sky, sort of dramatic sky up there. And of course, there is the line of mountains in the distance, but the main thing with the contrast between the black and then the lighter greys is that solid line of trees. So step three is to use a sturdy tripod and a good ball head or tripod head. Of course, if you're going to be doing long exposures, to keep the anchor object sharp, you're going to need to keep your camera very still during the exposure, and this requires a good steady tripod. One of the biggest mistakes that people make when they get involved in photography is underestimating the value of a good tripod. It's understandable, because when you first start out, you have the expense of getting a new camera, new lenses, maybe a camera bag, and these days, if you don't already have one, you're going to need a reasonably powerful computer, and there's all the software. It seems to be never ending. So the last thing people want to spend a lot of money on is, say, a $500 or even a $1,000 tripod. The problem is, at about the time you figure out why you need a good tripod, you probably also found out that, the one that you pick for $30 is about as useful as a chocolate frying pan. Don't get me wrong, I did this myself. I'm right there with you. The game is still changing though, believe me. I thought I was doing just the right thing buying a nice Manfrotto tripod for around $450, and I stuck an Acritech Ultimate ball head on there, both of which are excellent pieces of kit. But when I moved from a 12 megapixel camera with the 5D to a 21 megapixel camera with the 1DS Mark III, and now also the 5D Mark II, I found that with my longer lenses, you think of that as being heavier lenses like the 300mm f2.8, even with my $450 tripod, it wasn't quite cutting it. I'd given it a lot of hammer over the years, and it was a well-used tripod, but I think that if I went back and checked the specs, it probably would have been a bit small and not really even rated for such heavy gear either. The only way that I could get things locked down enough for good sharp results, and I'm not talking about with long exposures now, I'm talking about normal exposures. The only way that I could get things locked down enough for good sharp results with high resolution images was to buy a $1,000 Jitso tripod. The Acritech Ultimate ball head is still used from time to time on my second Jitso tripod. It's a great ball head. But my main ball head now is the Really Right Stuff BH55. This is simply an engineering work of art. It's not only operates beautifully and locks the camera in position, stopping it dead with no effort, but it's got a tension nut on there or a lock. I don't know exactly what you'd call it. So you can actually apply a little bit of tension and move it around and then let go, and it stays there. Really, really nice engineering. It also just really looks and feels great. We can get into that, the tripod head in more detail in another episode. The point is, buy the best tripod and ball head or tripod head that you can afford, especially if you're going to be doing long exposure photography. If your camera gets blown around in the wind, your exposure is going to end up with being all soft. So although people will go out and buy a cheaper tripod to begin with, and then usually a more expensive one, but not really the best later, you end up rebuying these things. So the main thing to take away here is, if you're just getting started and you're about to go out and buy a tripod, put as much emphasis on that purchase as you would one of your top lenses. So step four, use ISO and aperture to go long, but beware of diffraction. You should also use your lowest standard ISO for long exposures. Even if you're shooting in very dark conditions, set your ISO to the lowest standard setting, because you, if you start to bump that up, then you'll only get, you'll get shorter exposures, and obviously that's not what we want here. But also you'll start to introduce noise where you really just don't want that. Now, by the lowest standard ISO setting, I mean the lowest ISO rating that your camera has without going into any of the expanded ISO sort of ranges. If your camera has expanded ISO settings, like for example mine, the expanded ISO takes you down to ISO 50, it usually means that because that's not standard, if you have to set that some way by expanding the ISO range, it usually means that the manufacturer wasn't comfortable making those ISOs available by default for one reason or another. So if ISO 100 is the lowest that your camera will go to without making any custom settings, then use that. On my camera, I don't use the 50. I usually go with ISO 100 most of the time, but pretty much always unless I'm using highlight tone priority settings, in which case the ISO becomes 200, and that's my lowest ISO that I can use in that in those circumstances. Let's bring up image number 1668 now to help me make this point. We'll build on this later, but for now, note that in this image, I was using highlight tone priority to preserve highlights in the snow. And that meant that, my minimum ISO was going to be 200. I don't use highlight tone priority much now, but at the time, that was what I was thinking. And so, I thought I'd use this as an example of what I did. And also, the fact that the lowest ISO became different in this case. The next thing that you're going to want to think of after your ISO is about using a smaller aperture. Note though that if you stop your lens down too much, you'll find that diffraction starts to degrade your image. When we force light through a very small aperture, we start to lose resolution. It varies, but most lenses start to suffer from around f/16. I generally tend to try to avoid going down much lower than f/11, and I'll only go as low as f/16 when I really need to. And for me, f/22 or smaller is for emergencies only. And I only go there if I can really live with lack of sharpness in the resulting images. I shot these first two images that we looked at f/11, by the way. So step 5 is use a neutral density filter when there's still too much light. So when we have selected the lowest available ISO, we've gone to the smallest aperture that we can use, or we're prepared to use, we sometimes still have too much light in the scene for the length of exposure that we want. And that's when a neutral density or an ND filter comes in. I'll get back to what I used in the last image shortly, but for now, let me explain what an ND filter is. They're basically grey filters that cut out light without affecting the colour balance of the image. They are rated with a conveniently confusing number, such as ND2, which cuts out one stop of light. An ND4 is going to cut out two stops of light, and an ND8 is going to cut out three stops of light. There are much darker filters, such as the ND64 at 6 stops, and say the ND10,000 at 13 stops, etc. You may actually remember two wonderful PDF files that our good friend Landon Michelson put together that we released with episode 111. They were actually episode 111.1 and 0.2. You can still download those PDFs directly from iTunes or from the podcast's page at martinbaileyphotography.com. Well, I'm mentioning this right now because to save you trying to get your head around this too much, the first document contains information on the various density filters, their numbers, the ND numbers, and how many stops of light they cut out and all of that. So go back and check that out for more detail. Another type of ND filter that I should probably touch on before we do move on, and this is where I'm going to why I'm using this image that we've got up at the moment as an example. The filter that I'm talking about is a vary ND or a variable ND from Singray. This filter turns a little bit like a circular polarizer. You attach it to the front of the lens and then you turn it. And, although like contrary to common belief, this filter doesn't simply use two polarizing filters to work. All of the science behind it's different, I believe. But basically, the way it works, or the way you use the filter is very similar. In that, as you turn the front of the filter, you get a sort of variable amount of neutral density between 2 and 8 stops of exposure. And 8 stops, that's pretty significant. That's going to get you very slow. Going back to the image that we brought up earlier, this is why I'm saying it. I used a Singray Very ND filter for that shot to increase my shutter speed from probably, I don't know, maybe a 60th or so of a second. I've not done the math here, but it was nowhere near going to be slow enough to make the water run like that. And I ended up with like an 8 second exposure. And so, I'd literally just dialed in some darkness there so that I could sort of get rid of the movement in the water, get that nice silky effect. Basically, the variable ND is a little bit expensive, and it can actually create some weird and unwanted effects with wide angle lenses in certain types of light. So it's no magic bullet, but I find that it works well with longer lenses like the 70-200mm that I used here. And I can't remember exactly what I dialed in, like I said, but just literally turned the front of the lens, probably about 6 stops or so of darkness, for an 8 second exposure. And that really just gave me exactly the look that I wanted here, even though I was using an ISO of 200. So step 6 is to take the guesswork out of the exposure. If you're using a relatively dense neutral density filter, say an ND8 or below, and you're working at a time of day when you can't afford to do multi-minute exposures, only to find that you got it all wrong, you set the exposure wrong, you blew something out, it was too dark, and then there's really not enough time to go back and do another second shot, you really don't want to be messing around with that. So as you're preparing, the best thing to do is to meter and use your camera's meter without the ND filter on. Get to where you think you need to be, and then maybe even do a test shot. If we're shooting digital, you can look at it right away. Make sure, looking at your histogram, that it's where you want to be, and then you know what the exposure should be. And once you're happy with that, attach the ND filter. You know how many stops it's going to cut out, so you can then recalculate your exposure with the filter on and just manually change the exposure. You're going to want to switch to manual mode for that. If you use aperture priority, obviously you can do that as well, but the chances are that you may not. If you go like to 3 stops, then the chances are that exposure compensation is not going to have enough unless you've got one of the pro bodies. And even then, you're only talking 3 stops. So anything below ND8, and you've got to go to manual. So the thing is, basically, though, taking that filter off, making sure you know what your exposure is without the filter first is important when you don't have any time. If you've got all the time in the world, you can just bang it straight on and start to do your test shots, multi-minute test shots. But I personally think it can waste your time, and it could waste your shot if if you've only got a certain few minutes of light. So basically, you'll save yourself making a mistake if you take it off and do all of that calculation first. You might recall that I mentioned an iPhone application called ND Calc back in episode 177. If you find the mental arithmetic sort of difficult, or you just don't want to be thinking about stuff like that, then ND Calc is perfect for calculating the new exposure time in seconds, just by inputting the shutter speed that you start off with without the ND filter on there. And then the density of the filter, you dial that in, and it'll give you the new amount of shutter speed in seconds. So step 7 is focusing on what you can't really see. Focusing can be tough when it gets very, very dark. If you're working in normal light, of course, and the darkness is coming from the ND filter, a very dense ND filter, again, the best thing to do is to focus with the filter off and then put it on for when you want to actually take the shot. If the front element of your lens rotates when you focus, mind, you know, be careful that you don't rotate the lens while you're putting the ND filter back on, or obviously you'll throw the focus off. Even pushing the front of some lenses or grabbing the lens barrel, for example, can throw the focus off. So care is needed when you put the filter back on, but this will help you to focus while you can see before you put the dense filter back on. If it's already pretty dark, as it was when I shot the next image, number 2256, the chances are that you no longer even need an ND filter. Here I had some very faint light from the moon sort of half breaking through the clouds and reflecting off the sea, but this exposure took 4 minutes at f8, so you can probably imagine how faint the light on the scene was. I did a couple of things here though to focus. Basically, you know, I want to pass these on to you. The first one is through the lens, because there is a little bit of contrast there with the sea having the moon reflecting off it, I could just about see when the outline of the main subject, which is the gate here, was in focus by, you know, while turning the focus ring, you know, I really couldn't see very well at all. But while turning that focus ring, when you're looking through the viewfinder, you can just about make out the silhouette of the gate getting smaller as it got into sharp focus. And then as you go past that point, and it starts to go, you know, past its sharpest point, it starts to get bigger again. And you know, it's not always obvious at this with this light. It's not obvious that it's going out of focus, but you know, as it gets fuzzier, what's basically happening is it's growing. It's getting bigger. The fuzziness isn't obvious at first. So really, looking at when it becomes the smallest is a good indicator when you're trying to you know, focus with very, very low light. The other thing that I do is, you know, I have live view on my cameras now. And so, you know, when you use live view, if there is a tiny bit of light, then the image on the LCD can be very, very noisy, but it's worth giving it a try as well. If you zoom in to 5x magnification, you can, you know, you can just about see an outline of the gate, but you can see it more closely. And again, manually focusing, you can tell whether it's getting bigger or smaller. And the smallest point is when it's in its sharpest focus. So if there is simply not enough light to focus visually, you know, either through the viewfinder or on live view, a few other things that you can do. One is to, use the distance indicator on the barrel of the lens. If you use that, then you can usually guess roughly where, you know, roughly how far out you want it to be. And if you're focusing on hyperfocal distance, then that's easy. If you're trying to focus on something that, you know, may not be at hyperfocal distance, but it's, you know, you need it to be on that point, like the gate here, then you can sort of guess. And if you're at f8 with this sort of focal length, you've got a relatively wide depth of field, so you're going to get it just about right. The other thing is to take a powerful torch or flashlight with you and actually throw some light onto your subject while you focus. If the light is powerful enough, it may even give your camera enough light to autofocus, but at least it should be enough to manually focus accurately. Be sure to actually switch your camera lens into manual mode though, after, especially if you use autofocus, because if you don't, when you when you go to take the shot, if you haven't sort of moved the focus to the back focus button like I have. If you know, if it's still linked up to your shutter button, then when you go to actually shoot the image, you'll start to refocus again and you'll get that searching and you'll have to do it all over again. So don't forget to switch your lens into manual focus mode. Also, if you're shooting with other people around, you might mess up their photographs if you start shining a flashlight into the scenes. So be aware of that, and you know, don't mess things up for others. You could, of course, if you're alone, use that same flashlight to do some painting with light during a long exposure, which is fun, but it's another topic. So step 8, minimize camera shake with a cable release and mirror lockup. In addition to a good sturdy tripod, use a cable release or a remote timer switch, something to get with a cable to get the your hands away from the camera, basically. And that, because obviously that will cause vibration as you press the shutter button to start the exposure. If you're using a 30 second or less shutter speed, then you can use your camera's timer, which will, you know, generally somewhere either 10 or 2 seconds or both. Basically, you start the exposure with your finger, but then take your hand away 2 seconds or 10 seconds or however many seconds later, the exposure starts. And that usually gives the camera enough time for the vibration to die down. If your camera has live view and you use it, then you don't really need to worry too much about mirror lockup, because the mirror will already be locked up and out of the way when you trip the shutter. If you don't have live view though, or if at some point in the future live view changes, and that's very possible because things are still relatively new, the technology, you may need to set your camera to mirror lockup mode. It's basically where the first press of the shutter button makes your camera's mirror jump up out of the way, exposing the shutter in front of the film or sensor. And then when you press the shutter button again, the shutter is opened and the exposure starts. This helps, obviously, to reduce vibration, because the mirror action's finished, it's out of the way, and everything's all died down before the exposure starts. If you have a 2 second timer, you can often use this in conjunction with mirror lockup. So instead of having to do two presses, just one press will throw you into the timer, and then 2 seconds later, the exposure will automatically start. So step 9 is to use bulb mode. Most cameras' longest shutter speed is 30 seconds. If you're going to go past 30 seconds, you'll have to use the bulb mode, which is usually the B on the mode dial. This is basically where the camera's shutter will stay open for the whole time that you're holding the shutter button down. Here, when I say shutter button, obviously, after step 8, we know we're using a cable release. So I'm not talking about the camera, I'm talking about the button on the cable release. But basically, the whole time you've got that button held down, the shutter will be open. You can just hold the button for the entire exposure, but especially for really long exposures, it becomes a little bit tedious. Most cable releases have a little slider that you slide down, up or down over the button once it's pressed, to stop it from lifting up again until slide that little slider back. It's just going to effectively hold the button down for you. If you are timing your exposure, make sure that you use a stopwatch with a beep or something, an alarm, some way to let you know that the time's up. Or, you're basically, if you use something like the ND count that I mentioned for iPhone, that actually, if you're not only using it to calculate the time, but once you've got the time there, it actually gives you a little button to start a timer. And then when the countdown's done, it sort of plays a sound so that you know when to stop the exposure. Of course, before too long, the iPhone will probably talk directly to the camera and stop the exposure for you, but we're not quite there yet. The alternative to manually timing the exposure is a timer remote controller like Canon's TC80N3, which allows you to dial in how many minutes or seconds or hours, for that matter, that you want to continue to keep the camera shutter open. This is great for use in bulb mode. You can set the time of your required exposure, press the shutter button on the remote controller, which is basically just a fancy cable release, and then when the time's up, the shutter closes. One other word of advice that goes without saying, really, but I'm going to say it anyway, is when using bulb or doing really long exposure work, make sure that you have fully charged batteries in your camera. It wouldn't be fun to get halfway through a long exposure and your batteries go and die on you. So step 10 is noise reduction. Most cameras these days will default automatically to process images made with longer exposures to remove the noise in the camera. I find that the built-in noise reduction in the camera and in Lightroom is, Lightroom applies a little bit of its own noise reduction. I find that that's enough for shots like the ones we've looked at today. I haven't had to do any other noise reduction processing on these at all. For this last shot, even with a 4 minute exposure, there was just no real noise in the image after my camera had done its thing and Lightroom had applied its default noise reduction. Having said this, if you're shooting in warmer conditions, which tends to make more noise, or much longer exposures, and you do end up with a bit of noise. And also when I have images with noise from, say, high ISOs, things like that, I find that a piece of relatively inexpensive software called Noise Ninja from a company called Picture Code is pretty good. It does a great job of reducing the noise, and it's highly configurable, so you can avoid sort of getting that plastic feeling that some images have when it's been overdone. There's also a product called Neat Image out there, which is equally as good, I believe. I'll put a link to both of these products in the show notes so that you can download and try them, try them both out before you buy and see which one you like. And, if you need a third-party noise reduction product, at least, maybe take a look at that. And that's about it, really. So it's basically 9 sort of in-the-field steps, and then one that you'll need to use in post-production if you do end up with a bit of noise. So that's about it for my 10 tips for great long exposure images. If you haven't done any long exposures, I suggest you give it a try. It's great fun and can result in some excellent images. I'm going to be doing some even longer exposures as time allows, and I'll keep you up to date on what I come up with. Remember that I'm now taking bookings for the 2010 Snow Monkeys and Hokkaido Wildlife and Landscape Photography Tour and Workshops. If you're interested in joining us, check out the mbpworkshops.com website for full details and to book your place on any or all of the tours. It's going to be the Winter Wonderland Workshop of a Lifetime. Remember too that you can follow me on Twitter as Martin Bailey with no spaces between my names. This is probably the best way to sort of find out what I'm up to daily and to hear first where, anything you, I post anything useful or exciting there. And with that, all that remains to be said is you have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye. The Martin Bailey Photography Podcast is a proud member of the Photocast Network. Find this and other great photography podcasts at photocastnetwork.com.